This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 30th of December, 1957. The title of this lecture is Creating a Third Dynamic. This tape is 64 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
Well, now we're going to take up something interesting. Now, for a change, now we'll take up something very interesting. I'm going to take up a subject known as the survival clubs. The what? This is an idea. It's an idea you will hear more about, you will learn more about. Here, some congresses ago, we had ventured into the third dynamic. Was a very interesting adventure. We found out something so fantastic by venturing into the third dynamic that I do hope and trust that we will never adventure that way again. Which is simply this. As the dynamics fade out, the individuals drop down to the first dynamic. And a third dynamic activity or operation becomes all but impossible. It sounds weird because it asks this interesting question. How can you have a country? How can you have an organization? How can you have a business? And we adventured into this line simply to discover this. It was a test project. It went along fine. We tried to get people interested. We tried to get them interested. We tried to get them interested, and let me let you in on something. If I can't interest somebody, and if Dick can't interest somebody, and if Ken can't interest somebody, and if you can't interest somebody in something, we might as well quit. So this fantastic thing has taken place, that the dynamics, which number, of course, from 1 to 8, have paired off from 8 on down to 1. The urge towards survival, in terms of groups, has for some reason or other zeroed in America. Once upon a time, you could always issue, as George Washington did, a few casks of brandy and have a political campaign with a nice party on the lawn, get all the boys with you, and everybody said hurrah and three cheers. Once upon a time, political parties could amount to something, do something. Once upon a time, there was some influence could be rendered on the government by political parties. All we tried to do was to find out if the third dynamic was still attainable. We found out that it was not, which tells you why you have had a little difficulty getting a big group together. I feel for you. You keep tapping people on the shoulder, saying, come in. A century ago, the place would have been mobbed. Unless we do something about it, in another decade, not even you will be there. There are many problems which face us in the world today, which cliche has touched off practically every congressional speech, senatorial speech, news announcer statement. There are many problems. And it's the goddamnedest understatement that anybody ever made. Because nobody's facing these problems. What do you mean we face problems in the world today? You think the House and the Senate are facing any problems? Nah, they'd get solved. All you'd have to do is confront them. You mean to tell me that an overinflated slave economy can't be licked with propaganda alone? Certainly it can be. But nobody's facing the problem, so nobody licks it. The individuals of the country, however, are still individuals, and they still know they exist as individuals, and therefore a first dynamic operation is possible. Hence, you can make a first dynamic operation into a political philosophy. Has been done, but not quite with the thoroughness that we're going at. There's such a thing as rugged individualism. America was built on rugged individualism. Every man self-reliant. Minute men rushing up, grabbing their muskets every time the country was threatened and running like hell. I didn't say that. Now, we're not talking about rugged individualism. We're talking about individual service, serving the individual. It's a little bit different than the fellow ruggedly standing there with both feet. In order to get a group, you have to serve the individual. And on that stable datum, I'm afraid that it's necessary for us to operate for a little while. Therefore, if we springboard off the first dynamic, we can possibly get to the third. Possibly. How do you create a non-existent third dynamic? Well, it's just that. You create it. How do you create it? You have to appeal to the individual. You have to show him that he can be served. In order to show him that he can be served, you have to show him that he's in some danger. This will be his first cognition. Fellow standing there with a bundle of dynamite in his hand, the fuse lighted and so forth, he just goes on standing there. Somebody has to tap him on the shoulder these days and say, "Son, that dynamite is liable to blow up." At which moment he'll throw it at you. I don't say the country's all gone to hell. I don't say it's all beyond recovery. That happened about 50 years ago. We're starting from south. Now, what possible service could we be to an individual? Well, we could help him become more able. All right, that's fine. But unless we go at it as a group activity, it doesn't graduate into a third dynamic. It just betters the first. Well, now, how does political philosophy come into this? Let's scout this thing down very rapidly here. The political philosophy comes into it, but I'm sure this fellow will agree with you. If you take all of these first dynamics here, and raise their level a little bit, an IQ, that we will have a better third dynamic. In other words, the only thing necessary to bring about a great political reform in a country is simply to raise the intelligence of all the people in the country a few percent. That is the crux of this idea, but one that you probably will not talk about. But that's its political connotation. If you just raise everybody's IQ a few percent, why then, there they go, there they'll be all right. The fallacy of trying to educate people whose IQ and ability to receive is not up to being educated is that one does not educate them. They are not smart enough to be educated. A further step has to be taken. You have to raise everybody's IQ so they can be educated. But the funny part of it is, if you raise their IQ, they won't be educated in any stylized fashion. They will start to make up their own minds about some things. And only then can you have a democracy. Only then can you have a government, a third dynamic, on the basis of a democracy. you would have it if all of its citizens were able to understand and appreciate the issues before the government. I think you agree with that. Unless you do that, you're not going to have anything but a totalitarian state. Now, the way things are going, if we just force draft education in on people and so on and keep kicking them out and making them afraid, we will cut their IQ down. Now, if we keep cutting their IQ down and they become less and less able to confront, well, of course, they become less and less able to be a country. And sooner or later, some big fellow on a white horse, he used to ride a white horse, I don't know what he rides now, has to walk in and wave a sword and get a totalitarian regime. I think he probably waves a Cadillac now, or a Ford, or something of the sort. But these chaps who would give us totalitarianism themselves usually cannot face or confront problems, so totalitarianism has never been a solution. It never will be a solution. No matter how much we may begin to hear it whispered from here on out that what we need is a strong man with a bunch of slaves. No. It'd be fine if the country had a very brilliant person who could lead a democracy, if one existed. That would be fine. But he'd only be able to operate, this is what I'm getting at, if he had intelligent people. See, so the point is not leadership. Nor is the point political ologies. Communism, socialism, anarchy, or anything else are philosophies. They are philosophies. And so far, they haven't done very much good to people as political philosophies, because the world isn't getting better under these philosophies, but on the contrary, is marching up to a point where it's looks like it's about to wipe itself out. I know all of you have felt some concern, one kind or another, with the state of the United States and its government in this period of emergency. Now, there isn't much of an emergency. It's just that Russia put up a Sputnik and put up rockets, and we fired off a rocket, and it didn't go up, and we had crash program after crash program that didn't materialize, and this sort of thing is depressing. But that isn't really what's depressing. It's why doesn't somebody stand up and say something sensible? There's an awful lot of people in the Senate. There's an awful lot of people in Congress, and I'm sure all these people are people. They haven't said anything yet. They're going to increase the educational budget. Some hundreds of millions. No, look, the emergency is now. It's all right to have more schools and more education, but they're talking about when the guy gets out of school and they'll do something. Well, when's that? Anywhere from 5 to 16 years from now. This is the solution? Now, if the mathematics professors and the physics professors of the country have not so far been able to create geniuses and educate people, why do they think that another appropriation is going to? The solution is not more money, more hours, more education, or more government. The solution is obviously better citizens. What is a better citizen? By usual government definition, it's one who salutes. There is a hat called citizen. There is a hat called citizen. Definitely. It's taking the responsibility for one's role as a citizen, which isn't obeying the traffic laws, but contributing to the policies of the government. Oh, the government don't like that definition of citizen. One of the reasons why the U.S. government cleaves onto, adheres to foreign scientists. There's nothing wrong with foreign scientists except what I'm going to tell you now. They adhere to these fellows. They love them. They pull them into their bosoms for this reason. An American scientist has been educated with a certain tradition of having a say in what is done with his brain children. He believes that he should have some little say as to the applications of things, if only as a citizen. He believes that he can open his big mouth. And so we get Condon and Oppenheimer and so forth being investigated all over the place. For what? Not for communist affiliations. That's a lie. If you investigate the case of Dr. Condon, who was the very able director out here at the Bureau of Standards, and who is a fine physicist, you will discover that he's been under investigation for 5 years for advocating one thing: the translation of Russian scientific papers into English. He advocated this some years ago and obtained a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation to make it possible, and was at once branded as a subversive, and has been investigated continuously for 5 years, has been kept out of work, has been worried, has been harassed, has been cleared by each successive investigation, until evidently the opinion of just one man is all that stands between Dr. Condon and a decent job. The man can't even get a job. Right now he has some minor post in a university. 64 scientists we have done this to. Why? Well, I know several of them. Some 11 of those 64 are personal friends of mine. I have never shared their political views or their scientific amorality. I have not seen eye to eye with them at all, and they haven't seen eye to eye with me or with each other. But boy, did we open our big mouths! And Dr. Feller and Mr. Van Bruen, these characters, boy, do they keep their mouths shut well. Have they been trained? They only say the exact thing they're supposed to say when they're supposed to say it. And they do exactly what they're told. And the Army loves them. Dearly. Not because they're brighter, not because they're smarter, can get more done. We got 1,000 scientists in America better than either of these men. But because they say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, hell with this yes, sir, sir. The American scientist has not been taught to keep his mouth shut. I suppose this will be accomplished in the next few hundred years. But I hope it never occurs. He is not a subversive. He is a communicative. Not a communist. Now, this state of affairs is all part of the dwindling first dynamic. Obviously, some of these chaps who work for Hitler and so forth know how to keep on the right side of a shut comm line. Of course, somebody was upset the other day because I was upset about Von Braun. No reason why I shouldn't say this. The V2 came during the latter part of the war after Americans were in England. There's a cemetery in London where 25,000 Americans are buried who were killed by Dr. von Braun's slavish devotion to Adolf Schicklgruber. Nobody's going to persuade me to like the man. You get the point? Well, now, what I hold against him is that he serves any cause. He evidently has no principles. One moment he's for Nazism. I suppose if Russia offered him a quick buck, he'd be for them. That's my feeling about it. Like so many of us, I helped fight a war against these same Nazis. and against this same scientific might. And I don't see any particular reason why the United States should select such people over and above more competent scientists in this country, except for this one reason. They probably find them more obedient and less liable to express an opinion. Now, that's just a trend in government. That's all I'm showing you here. I have no fault to find with it. I'm not lecturing against it. If General Marcellus, or whatever this guy's name is that's been mucking up the atomic project and the missiles project lately, objects to us, why, fine, we object to him. It's mutual. But the point is this, that these... As you reduce a person's communication, so you reduce his intelligence. And let's extend this idea of the citizen mustn't open his big mouth out to the entirety of the citizens of the country, till we get to a point where we mustn't open our big mouths. You get the suppressive effect that could come, or maybe is coming about right now. That's less and less communication, which means less and less group, which means less and less country, which means less and less science, less weapons, less things to do with, less livingness. This dwindling spiral could become very serious unless something were done about it. Now, what I propose here is not particularly efficient or effective or the finest thing that could be done. It is merely something that could be done. And that has this superiority, that it can be done. You look that over carefully, and you find out that the best ideas cannot always be done. I see in nationalism today a fading star. Also, internationalism is a fading star. Neither of these philosophies are very popular because they've gotten us all into trouble. Now, I'm not saying that we should go against them. I'm just saying that we shouldn't preoccupy ourselves with them. I'm saying instead of worrying day and night about what the federal government is or is not going to do, instead of worrying about the fact that we apparently have no sweepingly effective leaders, instead of worrying about what they did do or didn't do, or what the Army says or didn't say, or what the Navy says about the Army, and so forth, instead of worrying about this sort of thing, would it not be possible to just skip it? That's a rather startling proposal, but just skip it. And be effective by making it possible for a country to exist sometime in the future. Instead of worrying about whether it exists now or whether it's functioning now, let's just get down to the grassroots and begin to grow a country, person by person, guy by guy, IQ by IQ. And sooner or later, these people will be smart enough to find some leaders and get a show on the road. Possibly the job will take so long that maybe all of us will have left for Arcturus and our sons and grandsons will be carrying on. Might be 100 years from now when something like this happened. But it has this faculty. If we do it, it will happen. If we don't do it, nothing will happen. Do you see this? So therefore, I'm not trying to tell you that this is a brilliant idea that's all going in the next 24 hours to sweep the problems of the world before it. But I am going to tell you that in 24 years, you would probably be seeing tremendous differences, chiefly because of this idea called the Survival Club. Its basic mission would be to raise the IQ of every man, woman, and child from border to border and coast to coast. one at a time. If you raised the IQ of everybody in the country 5%, you would certainly have a more enlightened country, that is for sure. Funny part of it is, it's very far from impossible. We don't even have to process them. We don't even have to process them. So that these survival clubs don't then become a series of processing projects as a direct, immediate thing. That's very direct. The country's not liable to accept this. We have to be more 1-1 than this. What we have to do, as far as I can see, is bring people together. Bring people together with the idea of survival by mutual activity to the benefit of the person himself surviving. Now, there's some second dynamic left, and the fellow will worry about his family. A lady will worry about her wife, her husband, and kids. Therefore, about as far as this goes is an extension, perhaps, into the family in this wise. The federal government, with what it laughingly calls civilian defense, has told us that in event of national disaster, we will all be on our own. Each one will be on his own. It is said that in many ways, in many places. I'm not now giving you an idle quote. I'm quoting you off the central plan sheets or everything that's handed to the public. You'll be on your own, it says. All right, the Survival Club says the same thing. It says the federal government says, we, in the event of national disaster, we will be on our own. Well, it proposes, let's all be on our own together. Well, now, that is a direct appeal, but you might have to sell somebody the fatality and horrors of atomic fission in order to get that thing across, so let's undercut it, huh? Let's undercut that. Let's talk about inflation. We already have inflation. Cost of living is going up. They, by the way, don't compute this by the percentages the way you think they do. And therefore, every once in a while, when you read, the cost of living is up 8%, you just had to pay twice as much for bacon. Don't be fooled, because the cost of living is computed differently than taking some former year and finding out the cost of bacon. You think that's the way they do it, but they don't do it that way. They do it with some mathematical formula known only to the Treasury Department. Nobody can ever question it. But inflation can be a serious thing, and already American families are eating too little on the average. When the supply of money is not adequate to provide a tremendous amount of food, the American family starts eating beans and spaghetti. Don't think they don't. You'll see people in Safeway now, they go in to pick up a piece of meat, have it weighed. Oh, they say, ugh. They have them whittle it down. They finally go home with a little piece of meat like this for family five. Not enough to eat. The reason it's not enough to eat is I think the government buys up all surpluses or something of the sort. But why should we worry about what the government is doing if the fact of inflation exists? We are not going to do anything about it by worrying about what the government is doing. Well, let's be practical. Let's no longer worry about the government. Let's just look at the fact. Inflation is already here. We don't care how it got here, but it's here. And the government has just raised its defense budget to $73 billion in the last 24 hours, has been announced. Wow. Do you know how you create an inflation? You find ways and means of pouring money out into the public, and ways and means of cutting production. And a $73 billion budget will do both. In other words, if you want inflation to occur, all you got to do is keep pipelining money, 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 more money, more money, more money out into the society. And then there's another method, which is take production out of the road. Reduce the number of things that can be bought. That puts more money into the public, too. Do you understand that? The government is just about to do both. If you don't think that inflation isn't around the corner, inflations can get pretty wild. When they start to go, they start going by the square and the cube. I don't think it'll ever be so bad because our production is pretty good. I don't think it'll ever be so bad that we will have to take a wheelbarrow load of money down to the corner to buy a loaf of bread. I don't think we will get up to that point. I just think we will have to take a $1,000 bill or something like that. I mean, I think we'll have a conservative inflation. When countries are marked for slaughter, inflation is a basic tool used against them. Every means is used against the country to create an inflation. Take China. A friend of mine in Pekin wrote me a letter, an old Chinese. He wrote me a letter. It cost him The first stamp I got from him was 7 yen. It cost for him to airmail a letter to me in the States. The next one was 24,000 yen stamps. And the next letter I got from him was 7.5 million yen. All of this within a space of about 6 months. The country was marked for slaughter. The Japanese use this system of bringing about an inflation. The communists use it. It's one of the methods of conquest. Well, I don't see that method of conquest being used here, except indirectly, by rattling sabers and upsetting people. They cause defense spending. Not wise spending, but just spending. And Congress says, well, the way to cope with it, don't find somebody that's intelligent. No, don't find a better administrator. Don't find some better scientist, a better idea. No, appropriate more money. Wow. They're playing right into this inflationary trend, don't you see?
This lecture is continued on side two of this cassette.
What would happen in an inflation? What would really happen to us? We've got a few dollars in the bank, and we won't buy anything. And production is down, everybody's discouraged. But we get a job, we work. Give you an idea, the civil servant of China during this inflation's pay stayed the same throughout the entire spiral. He was underpaid in the first place and it stayed the same throughout. It wasn't even worthwhile to go around to... Well, the only reason he'd collect his pay at all is to have some paper to burn in the fireplace so he could stay warm. They just would not have bought anything. I don't say to get this horrible. Weimar Republic, however, went this way, and a lot of other national organizations have gone this way. Once they start one of these things, there's nothing can put the brakes on it, evidently. Everybody says, well, we must be defended. We must be in good shape. All right. Suppose inflation came along and you had a survival club. Well, what could you sell somebody that would make him a very willing buyer on the first dynamic or even that little bit of the second dynamic? You could say, we want you to take out membership in this club. And in case of an inflation and a rising cost of living and a slackening of employment and a few things like that, you could still eat. How? Because we're going to take this money, and we're going to buy this big plot of land out here. We've already got an option on. It's got a house and so forth, and it's going to raise all sorts of things. And some of the members of the club will work it full-time, and other members of the club will invest a certain day's work a week and be paid in produce. And there won't be any cash involved in it if an inflation comes, but we can keep it turning over. Of course, any property that you buy in the face of an inflation is the most wonderful investment. It's worth $1,000 today, $10,000 tomorrow, $8 million next month. You want to hold property in an inflation. So this is a good economic move that way. Well, that's one of the ways you could sell people the idea of a survival club. First way, of course, is in time of national disaster, the government has told you to find some place to duck because it isn't going to give you one. Well, we've got a place to duck, and we guarantee that we will evacuate you and your family out to this area and give you food, clothing, shelter, and medical attention to the degree that these things exist or are within our means. And if we all get together on this, why, we'd probably be able to take care of one another. That is, just the club members. That's one. Two, in case of inflation, the area which we've got nailed down will produce. And might not feed everybody in the club, but it'll certainly go some distance toward feeding them and keep them from starving to death. Don't exaggerate the glories that you're going to sell them. They wouldn't buy it. Tell them the truth. So here's this club idea. All right, maybe people wouldn't like that. I mean, maybe the idea of the inflation, they say, well, the president will take care of it, the way a lot of people all say it. The president will take care of it. Secretary of the Treasury will do something if it ever gets that bad. Sure he will. He'll issue another $100 million $20 bills. Here's then basically the happiest thing you could sell them, a recreation area. And you say, well, wouldn't you like to have a place to go in the summer and a place to take a vacation, that sort of thing, and so on. We always have a recreation area, and we'll have planned recreational activities. All right, now supposing you had some water. You had a place on the water. You'd say, well, there's swimming, boating, fine, and even more important than that, if the defense highways are blocked, you can always use water as a highway. Defense highways are all liable to be blocked, believe me, even though they say now some of them will be open. In other words, there are a number of things that could be sold to people with regard to this particular idea. What do you mean, sell this thing to people? Well, you just get yourself a charter. I'm talking about you now. Get yourself a charter, survival club charter. You're properly registered and chartered and authoritative, and you get the literature as it comes out, and you probably get a business manager, or you get somebody who's a good salesman or something like this. You probably don't do the job yourself at all. And you show him this organizational setup, and he goes around and he simply calls on doors and he sells memberships in this survival club for recreation, possible subsistence, evacuation facilities, or anything else we come up with, don't you see? And we don't sell him this usually for $25 while you become a member of the survival club. That's a very stupid thing to do because of the possibility of inflation is as real to you as it is to the public. What we do is sell him a membership on some tiny percentage of his income, but we sell him a membership in the survival club for so many dollars a week or something like this. We say, well, every week give us a dollar and a half or something like that. See, some small amount that is continuing. It doesn't end up to the end of the year. That's just his contribution. In other words, you have a pledge to this club. And in return, it does so and so and so and so and so and so and guarantees such and such. And many of these things that you guarantee, of course, are very minor as far as he's concerned. Atomic fishing, why? Government's got missiles and they'll shoot all the bombs down that come in. There'll never be any danger from atomic fission and inflation. Why, everybody will take care of that. But they might get the idea that the wife and kids would be happier if they had some place where they could be taken, you know, on weekends and so forth for picnics and so on, particularly during the summer. This might seem like a good idea. And if there was some adjacent land where maybe they could be persuaded to build a small summer shack or something like this way, they'd say this is a pretty good idea. Member of the club and be a lot of interesting people and so forth. Sell it on a low note, an immediate note, and a now. See? You sell it now for what it can do now, not what it might be able to do in the future. But the actual thing about it is your gun cocked for just one thing. By recreation and by having them together, you've raised their participation and smartened them up. Now, inevitably, knowing you people, the cat will get out of the bag about Scientology somewhere along the line. But because you didn't bring them in there basically for that, you will probably have a tremendously large number of people that you'll eventually accumulate this way. There'll be lots of people, and there'll probably be only a fraction of those people that become interested this way. But there are a number of projects and programs on which such a club could act and enter, all based on the motive of survival. Survival of whom? Survival of you. Get the idea. You sell it to each person on the idea of his survival, his family's survival. If he has to evacuate the town or something like this, where's he going to go? And you can show him right in your local civil defense literature where it says he should have some place to go. Well, he doesn't want to go to the expense of buying a tremendous piece of land himself or even a little shack by himself. That would cost far too much money. You're going to take all of this off of his basis and do a service to the federal government, too. For a couple dollars a week, why, he'll have a place to go in case of disaster, in case he has to be evacuated the city. If he gets worried about that, there's a possibility he won't be, you'll say, it becomes subsistence. A certain amount of food would be your lot in case food became scarce or money wouldn't buy food. Or we simply sell it on a recreational basis. Think of how pale your children get in the winter time. Well, you don't want them all that pale all summer, too. And we'll have outings and so forth, and you can come out here. Now, actually, the sky is the limit. The size of the shape and shape of the club doesn't particularly matter. But let me show you a basic principle of organization which we so far have neglected. We are not too comprehensible to the guy on the street. That's the understatement of this Congress. Why aren't we? We are an organization that talks about theta and its interrelationship with the physical universe. And we would get no further talking to them about their souls. Now, very possibly the Christian could have talked to these people about their souls and gotten somewhere. Just that, you know. He could have gone around and said, you know, boy, you got a soul. You know, you can get 3 feet back of your head. You know that influences your mind. You know what your behavior and ability has to do with the fact that you are a spirit and you influence this body. This isn't the message which we ordinarily shove out, but if the Christian probably could have gotten someplace doing that. But he didn't, and I think it's because he couldn't get to first base without backing up sin. I think he had to have sin and save your soul. I don't know where these Christians kept their souls back in the early days. I get the awfulest start sometime when I'm reading some literature and they say, well, you ought to do this and that to save your soul. And I say, huh? I feel haunted. And the Christian, however, had to run in a bunch of interesting ideas about sin. And the next thing you know, instead of doing with the soul, why, he was building the doggondest, biggest churches you ever saw. Man, do they have mass. Any spiritual activity eventually accumulates mass. The Christian Scientist is a very good scientist right now. Christian Scientist certainly accumulates lots of mass. They've got mass all over the place. The Egyptians way back when, this is not comparing them to Christian Science, but the Egyptian way back when, in dealing with the spirit, built pyramids. See, I mean, it's kind of weird. Now, we could be classified as that organization which is 3 feet back of society's head. We have ideas. We can confront these problems. We can see what they ought to be doing. And we're, in essence, We're not a thetan running the society as a body. Not that crude. But we come closer to it than anything else we're doing. And bodies don't know about thetans. You got the idea? And we might go from now till the end of time, you see, being totally unknown to the society at large and bodies. Now, I ask you this question. Is there anything wrong with this? No, not providing you can also get communication. In order to get communication, you've got to build some additional bodies. You've got to build some bodies that are in communication. You got that? If you can't be talked to directly, then let somebody talk to you on a via, just like you carry a flesh and blood body around, and people talk to it, and so you get the communication. You get the idea? Well, this obviously is a successful pattern because it's in use. It's the most successful pattern anybody knows about, to have a body in order to communicate. You got it? Well, supposing we built this organization called a survival club, and we were only vaguely 3 feet back of its head. But everybody comes along and they see this organization called the Survival Club, and it has committees and membership, and all of its members are busy, and you get them planning and cross-planning, and you have meetings, and you have people arguing with other people because they didn't pay their dues, and you got randomity going in all directions, and the only thing they're trying to do, basically, socially, is simply to have a club. Socially, they're trying to have a club, and then the next thing right up the line, what they're trying to do is maybe make people a little smarter or a little more able. They kind of get this through their heads, that it might be possible that the social significance of it depended on this, that they can't have any unable people in their midst because it'd slow them down. They probably get this idea eventually, but they don't stress that idea at all. You're a good fellow. You're a Scientologist, head shrinker. You're supposed to know all about this sort of thing. But you know about the mind. They possibly don't even see you as a basically influencing factor in the thing, even though possibly you've got your name on the organization papers as having total control of it. You might have your name, John Doe, on the organization papers, and right there, and it says, If anybody tries to knock John Doe out of control of this organization, that member will be shot. And they probably still not see who you were or what you were. See, you shouldn't worry too much about your control of it. What you should do, take a leaf from my book, try to keep giving that control away. You don't get any place. You control it. You do it. Here's this organization, then, which comprises bodies, people, messed, activities, all sorts of things going on for lots of good reasons. And it's a body of people, and they go on, and just because they have a purpose, they have a goal, they are doing something about the future, they aren't totally defeated with regard to the government and the country and so forth, because they are doing something that could prevent some of these things. Some hope has been interjected there. Some recreation, because they get out in the open once in a while. And sometimes, because you get a few of them and process them, their IQ certainly comes up, their ability comes up, and they're able to cope. The ability to cope with the situation in general comes up. And if you did this to an sufficient extent, I don't say that you should put your membership out to 200 million or whatever the membership of the U.S. will be shortly. I think that this club will think of itself as the organization 2 feet back of the society's head. And here will be the society as far as the club is concerned. The club will be doing something down here about the society. You know, trying to get certain reforms accomplished in the city, trying to get the garbage collected on schedule, not thrown out in the streets. And you get the idea. They will think of themselves as an organization which controls some section of this society, don't you see? Now, that's a successful mock-up. It couldn't fail as a mock-up. Unless, of course, you thought you knew more about business than the business manager and you took all responsibility on yourself with regard to the whole club. Then you could have a pretty good chance of falling on his face. You want to have somebody else to blame, always have somebody else to blame. That's the primary point of organization. So here you've got your... Here you've got your committee heads. I'll give you a clue on organization. Always appoint a committee as one. Always fill a post. Don't appoint a committee. Committees never get anything done because that's all an irresponsibility. Just appoint posts. Make sure that every function the club has somebody in charge of it. And then make sure that the appointment of these people can be blamed on a few up here at the top. And you'll find out it isn't all that vital to get the show on the road inside this club that exactly, because the club isn't a life or death proposition. Yes, it becomes life and death maybe when you've got this, you've just bought a 1,000-acre farm or something, or you have options on it and so on. There's so much money to come due and you're not making the membership on it and so forth. There are some things there that might look a little touch and go to you. But these people can probably solve them. So I wouldn't worry about it, because they will. The main thing I'm saying is that an organization which has a multiple, not apparent purpose would probably be very successful. You get a business manager, a pretty good promoter, and he hires a few salesmen around town who go around evenings, and they simply sell memberships and back up the hearse or whatever else they've got to do to sell memberships, and they get names on the Survival Club pledges, and the USA clubs are sold to them and the membership, and they'll get out from under in case of atomic war or something like this. You're not trying to sell them religion or getting better, or you're not trying to sell them anything but self-preservation, which is usually easy to sell. And it doesn't cost any fabulous amount. Your finances on the thing tend to work themselves out one way or the other. Furthermore, the organization here will have this and its literature pretty well codified and organized. You're not exactly sailing out into the blue. Now, you may or may not know this, and it probably isn't important anyway. I was a member of Naval Civil Affairs at the end of the last war. And they sent me to the Princeton School of Government. Well, they had to get a 4-year education done in a few months, and they were actually doing a pretty good job, because all they were trying to do was smarten some guys up so they wouldn't lay too big an egg when they got out amongst disaster populaces. Therefore, my interest in the subject of disaster relief has been greater, perhaps, than it would have been otherwise, having been educated in the subject. I was once, by the way, a field executive of the American Red Cross in the Puerto Rico hurricane disaster. And these things have some reality to me, you know? I mean, it isn't very unreal. And the thing that I have the greatest reality on is it's awfully easy. It's awfully easy to form groups to take care of disasters. And why civil defense is unable to recruit people to do this, I wouldn't have a clue, unless their program is so lousy that the people that they're trying to recruit see through it at once as a fraud or something. It must be a terribly bad program. Nobody's signing up for civil defense these days. They've deserted this sphere. Well, disaster relief or organizations to lead toward the survival of peoples are not very complicated organizations. For this reason, the people themselves, each one, have some desire or some knowingness on the subject. You get the idea. You're using native talent. Now you'll understand better when I say an auditor has to be, really, to get good results, has to be trained as an auditor. You've got that? Well, a couple of mechanics and a filling station operator don't need very much education to be your transportation officials. You got that? So all you have to do is throw them the idea, how are we going to get 3,000 survivors transported from the city out to this evacuation area? Why sit around and jam your wheels with it, see? You find some guys that know something about wheels, and you say, it's your baby. Now, you're in charge, and you make sure it's done, and we'll hold you liable for it, and you give us a report every meeting on what you've done in order to organize this thing. You see that? In other words, you're dealing with something where you have tremendous quantities of native ability, where you don't have to do a great deal of education. You can pick and choose. Now, the mistake would be to just do everything for the people and set up a service that does everything for the people, and that's that. Now, you're going to be a slicker. Because remember, basically, even if this is known only to you, this is a therapeutic operation. You shove the responsibility at them. You shove them the problems. Soundly enough, organized, basically, in the organization, so there's some way they can do something about the problems if they think of an answer. You put them into communication with one another with regard to these problems, and you get them tremendously interested in it. All right, we have a survival club team, and it has 20 basic offices. And that doesn't care whether we're getting in recreation, or whether we're working about inflation, or whether we're working about atomic disaster, or what we're working on. There are 20 offices. We're going to have a picnic. Let me assure you that you've got to have all of these officers at a picnic, even the medical. See, they've all got to be present at the picnic just as they would be at the disaster. Just make sure that they have countless assistants so that they get so busy trying to keep their assistants busy that they never have any time to be critical of what you're doing. Now, it's quite interesting. But you're adding goals and purposes to people. And you're taking a society which is relatively purposeless, and you're putting purposes into their heads. We don't care what the purpose is. The purpose is, every few weeks we'll have a picnic. Every Saturday night we will have a dance. We'll own a piece of property that has a big barn. The thing, by the way, has to be from about 35 to 50 miles away from town in order to be in a safe area. Outside an atomic fallout, even then it might be a little dangerous, but you have provisions against that. If you've got programs, you know, and if the programs aren't going right and the members aren't turning up, well, blame the members and ask them for suggestions and get them all together to remedy this horrible thing. They'll come up with ways and means of doing it. If they're inefficient, if the club isn't running efficiently, all you have to do is tell them to run it better. When I say you tell them, you wouldn't even have to be an officer. It's just propaganda that you put around. The art and skill of being an executive is being an expert agent provocateur. That's being an executive. Some people think it's being an organizational expert. No, it's just provoking people until they'll organize. The capitalist failed because he got them to organize against him. That wasn't smart. Now, here then is a survival club idea. United Survival Action Clubs. The reason they're called that is just so you can say USA Club. But the loose term is survival club. You want a group. You want people you can talk with. You'll find these people take quite a while with another purpose together before you could talk to them about anything like Scientology or better IQs or anything else. But if they are performing their job well, they will be getting better and you will be making a country and a government possible. You want a group? Don't try to form them on the basis of Scientology, just per se and as such. All you want is to get some bodies together. And I'm giving you an idea of how you get some bodies together. Put the bodies together, even though it's apparently quite distant from what you're doing, because there will be a group of bodies which will become a group, which will become itself a body that you can communicate with to the society at large. And you can't talk worth a nickel without a body. I know, I processed some of you. Get you up in the middle of the room, what you do? Squeak. Well, now you're doing that with society at large right now. You have not accumulated a body to talk with. Do you understand that? Well, don't think Scientology couldn't talk loud and long. If you all, those of you who are interested in this, did your job well in organizing survival clubs, or many survival clubs in your area, and these were all united together under a central club that fed literature and coordinated ideas and activities and published club news and interchanged it all, don't think Scientology wouldn't have a voice. You would be able to talk. Now, I dare say that this idea will not get there and prevent an atomic war. I dare say that it's not probable. Well, when these people back up the hearse to you about atomic war, remember one thing, that there will be tremendous numbers of people left alive. Just be one of them, that's the trick. Actually, in even a heavily bombed area, about 50% of the populace directly under the bomb still lived. Now, what are you going to do about these people? Now, we don't care about the morals of the situation or who bombed it or what. Chicago isn't going to be able to help Denver. Denver isn't going to be able to help San Francisco. The cities are all on their own. The government thinks that it'll have cars of relief workers to pour into the area. Oh, no, it won't. Cops get killed just like everybody else. The thing will be utter and complete chaos. And it is that chaos which will destroy your country, not the casualties. And all you've got to have is a few groups that know what they're doing, they're advised on the situation, and have 50% of their members survive. That's the worst kind of an emergency we could get hold of in this atomic age. To have a country that can still talk and act democratically. I don't say we're going to have 100 million members. But 100,000 people left alive and organized and knowing where they are going after atomic disaster could mean the survival of America. And therefore, I think the project is worth doing on those grounds, on the grounds of intelligence, and on the grounds of just getting a show on the road. And probably the most important grounds of all, I think it would be fun. Thank you. Thank you.